Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. We're going to dip into the archives in a little bit to replay an old interview. We'll get to that in a moment. But I do want to mention opening in theaters this weekend, besides the latest action film from Gerard Butler, is the documentary One Child Nation, about the history of the One Child policy that was in China for about 35 years. And the narrator and the main focal point is a young woman who found out, was born under that policy, and then was doing everything to raising a child in the United States, going back to China, going back to her village, interviewing the former village chief, interviewing the midwife that brought her into the world, the midwife that also did sterilizations and abortions. A mixture of, since the policy lasted until 2015. And there is a lot of people still not wanting to talk about this. There's a fairly tense scene with old ladies playing cards while this young lady is interviewing the former village chief. And it's very, very tense. We have an artist also featured in the film that wound up making some controversial artwork involving images and found fetuses that were tossed aside in the road. A lot of propaganda filled the walls of many, many villages in China over this policy from the early 80s until, as I said, 2015. And the narrator of this is also guilty, and it's self-admitting, to being in a choir and singing songs. There were songs about maintaining this rule. There were notes about turning people in if somebody was pregnant with a second child or a third child. There was also the dark market of human trafficking and or matchmakers, which would send babies to couples that did not have children. I knew about the policy. It's a fascinating look into that world and the governmental spin behind it. Reporting your neighbors and getting a $120 reward just because somebody is having a baby. What is brought up, of course, is how is China similar than the U.S. women's body rights and issues. So, anyway, it's in theaters. It's at your local art house, the one that shows the documentaries. Also, a cool note that the crew members of this film were all Chinese and born under this policy, as noted. So anyway, to find out more about One Child Nation, it's out. Go check that out. Need to raise a glass a little bit. This happened right after the recording of last week's program, and thanks again for John Ketzenberger for hanging out and talking Springsteen. But animator Richard Williams passed away. He died on August 16th at the age of 86, best known for the animation director for Who Framed Roger Rabbit in 1988. Going back through his credits in IMDb, was also lead animator on Thief and the Cobbler from 1993, did the animation sequences for The Pink Panther Strikes Again and Return of the Pink Panther, did the animation sequences in 1968's Charge of the Light Brigade. And there was a film of note. I didn't realize that he not only was the head animator, but also the director of. I mentioned he directed the film The Thief and the Cobbler from 1993. He also directed 1977's Raggedy Ann and Andy, A Musical Adventure. And I've mentioned this on the show before, as one of the odd, dark animated films that were shown in the 1970s. I remember this being on the – we used to have Channel 100 up in Michigan. This is pre-HBO. And I remember that was where I saw The Mouse and His Child, Watership Down, Fantastic Planet, and this film. And I remember – I have to look back into it, but I remember Dee Dee Khan was the voice of Raggedy Ann, for you fans of Grease and You Light Up My Life. But it's Raggedy Ann and Andy, and there is a girl who's kidnapped by pirates, and Raggedy Ann and Andy, of course, try to rescue her. And when they finally get to her, they find out that she's sort of become Pirate Patty Hearst. I mean, it's a really you think of these two dolls, which were a mainstay for children, especially girls and some boys. Nothing wrong with that. Back in the 60s and 70s, I forget how long Raggedy Ann and Andy have been in existence, but just an odd, weird animated film. And Richard Williams directed that. So thanks, Richard. And of course, Peter Fonda, best known for Easy Rider, which he wrote and also directed The Hired Hand, Idaho Transfer, and Wanda, Nevada, all fascinating cinematic oddities if you get a chance. Of course, one of my favorite autobiography title of all time was his, called Don't Tell Dad, because of his dad, Henry Fonda. Of course, there's older sister Jane. And was an actor who tried to work in the studio system in the 60s, and especially being under the tutelage of dad, and then had the change in 1966 with a film with the AIP films, The Wild Angels and The Trip. And then 1969 helped start the youth boom with Easy Rider, and then appeared, as I mentioned, and starred and directed in The Hired Hand, was in Dennis Hopper's follow-up, The Last Movie. The stuff that Fonda did as a star in the 70s, maybe borderline A-B level if you're into leveling those films, but was in many a drive-in with, of course, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Hi, Susan George, Open Season, Race with the Devil, 92 in the Shade, The Diamond Mercenaries, Fighting Mad, Future World, Outlaw Blues. This was one that was on Channel 100 a lot. High Ballin', a trucker movie with Jerry Reed and not Burt Reynolds. Wanda, Nevada, Split Image, made fun of his image in Cannonball Run, and then was just constantly working. Bodies, Rest in Motion, Love in a 45, weird cameo in Escape from L.A. And I made reference to Fonda on last week's show before finding out about his death with a show I saw in Edinburgh, Scotland, called The Shark is Broken. It was something that was co-written and featured Ian Shaw, one of the nine children of actor Robert Shaw, playing his father as Quint. That moment of, and according to the program, Ian Shaw had grown a mustache for another play and then looked in the mirror and realized he looked like his dad in Jaws. And the other comparisons I think of are Jared Harris in Mad Men. There was just a particular episode. I'm like, oh, you look just like your dad, Richard. And, of course, Peter got that, looking like his dad in what he should have won Best Actor for, this, no disrespect to Jack Nicholson, 1997's Yulee's Gold, where he plays a beekeeper with his family coming in the town with lots of problems and lots of danger. So really lovely performance from Peter Fonda in that. Played Terry Valentine in Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, a must-watch. Yeah, he was in Wild Hogs and Ghost Rider, but he was also in the remake of 310 to Yuma. That helps balance out Boondock Saints 2. But he was one that was always working. The last thing I know of note, actually the last thing I saw him in was probably Boondock Saints 2, and that was 10 years ago. But I know I do need to rent The Ballad of Lefty Brown. He appeared in that, but was constantly working right up until the end. So, Peter Fonda, thank you for your work, and thank you for the counterculture in Hollywood. We needed that. So you can watch Easy Rider and then go watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood if you're into that sort of thing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to dip into the archives. This archive interview goes out to my buddy Spencer, because I wound up dropping this name, and I don't think I've played this in a long, long time. But we're going to go back to 2010 when Emma was in studio with me as well, but it was a very hush hush thing. He was in town, going to do a, if I remember right, a lecture with the Indianapolis Public Library system. But I got in studio author Neil Gaiman. So here's me trying to catch up, hold on and catch up and try to talk movies with author Neil Gaiman. Spencer, this one's for you, pal. Enjoy. Well, Neil, I didn't realize I had royalty in my studio, because I know you have an official title, so I need to kiss your ring or your scepter or what? Your crown.
I have an official title, but only for a week.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to renew that.
No, I have inherited my title from, I think, Julie Andrews, and I do not know who I will be handing it on to next year, but I am the honorary chairman of National Library Week. I get to be a spokesperson for all of the libraries in America, and I get to tell people not to close them and to go and use them and to cherish them.
Ah, so you came to Indianapolis at the right time.
I did.
Are we chaining ourselves to any libraries in the next couple of days?
Well, I'm actually going to be giving a big talk tonight that is absolutely sponsored by your local library world, which is rather wonderful. But no, I won't be chaining myself to any railings or throwing myself under horses. I'm just going to be urging people to use their libraries and to know what they've got. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in this world now where I keep hearing people telling me that libraries are so incredibly 20th century, as if Google replaced the library somehow, and trying to explain to them that the nature of information retrieval has simply changed.
I think with libraries, and for lack of a better comparison, video stores. I know, yes, you can get anything on the web and get it mailed to your home, and you don't have to see human beings. But I still think, especially a library, is a great example of the search, the hunt, and whether you get what you're looking for or you find something else that comes along your path. I think that's a thrill that needs to remain.
I look back at the years I spent as a schoolboy, hanging around school libraries, discovering books that I did not know that I wanted. They weren't things that I was looking for. In many cases, they looked extremely unprepossessing. I remember some very, very old, battered-looking red hardbacks. One was called The Fellowship of the Ring, which seemed an incredibly unlikely sort of title. And then they had one called The Two Towers, and there were just two out of these apparently three books. And reading them and then getting to the end of The Two Towers and going, it can't end there. And so going back to the beginning and just reading those first two books of Lord of the Rings over and over again. And I don't know that I would ever have picked them up. But they were in the school library, and I was reading my way through it. So I read them.
And now they're on Blu-ray. And you can't read Blu-ray, really.
You can't. or you have sensitive fingers, possibly, to run around the disc.
That's true. Braille. What are you currently working on? I mean, whatever medium. It's literature, comic, film. What's in your office?
Right now, it's a bit of a gallimaufry. I've got, what am I working on? I'm doing a rewrite of an episode of Doctor Who that I wrote.
Oh.
I wrote an episode for the current season that was meant to be episode 11, but we ran out of budget. So my episode got bounced to early in season 6. So I'm doing a rewrite to take care of continuity issues and things from where it was to where it will be. I'm writing a film script for Anansi Boys, my novel. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a nonfiction book about China and myth and history, which I'm starting to get into and starting to enjoy. And writing a little children's book in down moments right now.
How do you select down moments? Or, I mean, as far as juggling and writing, I mean, is it based on what creativity comes from this project or deadlines? Or, I mean,
Well, there's definitely a level on which who is shouting loudest for something and when it was really due by and when it is due by and whether or not their lawyers have started sending letters saying, please note the date of the actual contractual delivery has now passed by several years and we will ask for our money back. These are all important things in what you work on. And then there's other things like what you feel like working on that day. And I always like to have something on the go in little notebooks just to hand, because you never know when you're going to wind up stuck on a plane or a hotel or an airport lobby or somewhere. And it's really nice to just sort of go and go visit somewhere fictional.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, I love the idea of the credit writer slash producer. You know, many people say, like, when they argue about the Academy Awards, that really producer and director, best film, best picture and best director should be the same. And some of us say that best writer and best picture should be the same. So I'm wondering, I know you were executive producer on Beowulf and producer on Stardust. How much were you able, and I don't mean this way this sort of sounds, but I mean, how much creative control did you have in collaborating with both directors of those films?
I think the truth is that film will always be subject to budget limitations, a director's medium. I've now directed a couple of films, not very long ones. I did a half-hour film a few years ago, and last summer I had enormous fun directing an 8.5-minute silent movie called Statuesque, which got starring Bill Nye. And in each case, what I liked best was I had the same power that I have as a writer in writing prose, which is the power of because I say so. Why is it like this? Because I say so. It's going to be like this. And that's something that you could have every producerial description in the book applied to you, whether it's executive producer, or you can be the boss of a studio. And the truth is, a director is going to make the film the director wants to make. And the director is the only person in a film, really, who has because I say so power.
How have you liked the film versions of your work so far?
I've really enjoyed them. I think I'm tremendously lucky.
Yeah, you have no visible scars, so it seems like it's
no. I really don't. I I'm fascinated by them. I think people think I'm a bit odd because I tend to take an incredibly long term view anyway, and I think of film adaptations of my stuff as being kind of like theatrical adaptations, which is they come, they go, they're really interesting, but the book is still the thing. I love Stardust, the movie that Matthew Vaughn made. I was a producer on it. I really, really enjoyed it. I can also absolutely imagine a world in which 15 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody picks up the book, reads it, goes, I love this book. Then they look at the film that Matthew made and they go, you know, I want to do a different one. Mm-hmm. I reading this book, I'd love to make a movie of this, but it would be a completely different movie. It wouldn't be a sort of rollicking, comedic...
De Niro and drag. The most beautiful
thriller.
Witch in cinema history.
Absolutely. You know, it wouldn't be that thing. It would be something else. Coraline, I think, was slightly different in that for Coraline, when I finished the book, this is when I finished writing the book, 10 years ago, I looked at what I'd written and I thought, I would love this filmed. And then I thought, but if you filmed it live action, you're going to get something that no adult would be able to watch without being too creeped out. And I'm not even sure that kids would enjoy it. And I thought, but I love Henry Selick's work. I'd mm-hmm. loved Henry most famously directed a film, or before Coraline most famously directed a film called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which a lot of people, because of the title, think was directed by Tim Burton.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was by Henry. And I had seen the credits on that, and I had registered who directed it and who made that film. And likewise James and the Giant Peach. So for me, there was only one person I wanted to do Coraline and only one person I was going to send the book to when it was finished, which was Henry. And fortunately for both of us, he read it, he loved it. And then it took us about 5 or 6 years to get it set up. And then because it was stop motion, which is the most labor-intensive form of filmmaking on the planet, it took, you know, a year of pre-production, set building and model building, and then 2 years of shooting. And on a really, really good day, they might get 11 seconds in the can.
And he has, of all the animators out there, I think his look is the most visible. You may not know him by name, but you know that look with the three films that you mentioned. And also, I think last year is going to go down as one of the best, if not arguably the best year for film animation between all of the stuff that was nominated. And congrats on the nomination.
It was so strange being in that year. And that we got an Oscar nomination in what may have been the best year for animation ever was an honor in itself.
And that could have been a category with 10.
Oh, it could easily have been a category with 10. And also, there was a level on which, and I say this in the best possible way, Up was nominated for Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
which meant, and you sort of look at that and you go, well, it won't get Best Picture, but it has to get Best Animated Picture because it's been nominated for Best Picture. So it was the most stress-free Academy Awards possible. We knew that Up would win. Everybody involved knew that Up would win. And
you got your swag bag and went out drinking afterwards.
And we had a wonderful time. Exactly. So from that perspective, it was great. I got to write the thing that I wrote that I think has had the most number of people ever seeing it, which is 15 seconds of Coraline dialogue in the Academy Awards. I wrote that for them, that little scene, and I'm going, I think that there's something ridiculous, like 250 million people watching this right mm-hmm. now.
It's fabulous. When it comes to adapting your work, first off, do you have it strictly that, you know, you get to adapt your own work and nobody else, or is it, I mean...
Truthfully, I prefer it when other people adapt my work.
Okay.
And I'm currently battling my way through an Anansi Boys adaptation that reminds me. The only reason I said yes to it was the BBC World Service had just done a radio adaptation of Anansi Boys that I had not liked and really hadn't liked, which meant that about a week after, I got a call from Warner Brothers saying they would like to buy the rights to Anansi Boys. Would I like to adapt it? And I was like, yes, I really do. Because I want to do this properly. Now that I'm doing it, I'm remembering why I normally say no to adapting other people's stuff, which is simply, in order to build the thing in the first place, your mind goes down certain paths. When you're transferring something into a film, you either want to do exactly the same thing that you did before, which is a bit dull if you're a writer,
mm-hmm.
or you want to do something completely different just because it's fun and you haven't written it. And neither of these is I think, terribly healthy for a writer. It's much more fun for me adapting something by somebody else because then I can go with a completely clean conscience. I can look at it and go, well, you know, we can lose that character. I can't do that with my stuff. If I go, we can lose that character, in the back of my head that character is going, no, why me? I was a good character. I was obedient. You can't lose me.
Well, I was curious also about your adaptation of Beowulf, because it seemed more, especially after a certain animated action film had come out, but it seemed more like a Shakespearean tragedy than, say, beefy guys screaming and hacking at one another.
It's a very odd film, Beowulf, isn't it? I mean, I think part of the fun of that, and which is one of the things that some people like and some people don't, and different people react to in different ways, is what Roger Avery and I wrote a script for in our heads was for a $15-20 million low budget lots of mud and dirt Beowulf that would have been kind of like Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky.
I was saying, my first thought was Excalibur.
I think in our heads we had a weird mixture of Excalibur, Jabberwocky, and maybe Monty Python and the Holy Grail in terms of that kind of what we were trying to do. Bob Zemeckis fell in love with the script. And then, which suddenly meant that it was a thing starring Anthony Hopkins and Angelina Jolie and people. And Bob is also fascinated right now by motion capture mm-hmm. and by performance capture and by ways of trying to do the thing where you get to mix live action performances with an animated thing that you're seeing on the screen. So it became this kind of thing that looks like a video game, but doesn't necessarily deliver. I think for a lot of people, it looked too much like a video game for the people who actually really would have loved the Shakespearean
right.
oddness. And it was too little like a video game for the people who would have really liked a video game movie. And the people who, for whom it would have been very funny and very weird if we'd actually done it as a Jabberwocky thing, they never really got to see that. I think Roger Ebert was about the only film critic I saw who basically said, I think I'm the only film critic who has noticed this is funny. And it is funny. And it's funny. People, it's funny, which I loved.
Now, I went online, because that's where I get all my research, and I saw that there's five titles in your IMDb page under In Development. So may I throw titles at you and
throw,
you can comment?
Throw titles at I have to say that as far as I can tell, IMDb has the same kind of reliability as Wikipedia, which is anybody can go on and add anything they like.
Well, we're gonna straighten this out.
So go for it.
Here we go.
For it.
All right. Graveyard Book.
Definitely in development. Neil Jordan is writing the script currently and is meant to be directing it.
Okay.
There's serious hope that we could be shooting by the end of the year.
Death, High Cost of Living.
Don't know. It's Death, the High Cost of Living is kind of like traffic lights. You know, I always thought when I was a young person entering the world of Hollywood nervously that the expression a green light meant that you actually had a proper green light for your film and you would go. And I didn't realize that it was kind of like traffic lights, because green lights for death go on, and then they go yellow, and then they go red, and then they go...
I was thinking the Monty Python song, but yeah, that's one of
those. So it's very, very strange. Had you asked me that 4 days ago, I would have told you that we were closer than ever before to things happening. I'd just been contacted and the deal had just been done for me to go in and do a rewrite of my original script, and everything was grand. As of 2 days ago, Warner's apparently suddenly have had a unified field theory for the entirety of Sandman and everything I created, which no longer involves, for which death is now on hold. So I don't know. We'll find out.
We'll call you next week.
Exactly.
Road to Endor.
Road to Endor is wandering along. And it's kind of fun. It's a script that I've written with Penn Jillette of
wow.
Penn and Teller film.
Yes.
A true story about two guys in 1917 who escaped from a Turkish prisoner of war camp by pretending to have psychic powers and doing stage magic. And it's a completely true story about these wonderful people. And the producer... There's a producer named Hilary Bevan-Jones who I've worked with in London, who actually produced Pirate Radio. She produced The Girl in the Cafe. And it actually happened to her grandfather. Her grandfather was one of these two people.
Oh, wow.
So she's working with us on it. Cool. And we're just waiting for... There is a director that we want. He wants to do it. He's been tied up on a franchise of films that has occupied him for several years now. I believe he's shooting the last of them currently, and then we'll see if he's available.
Okay. Interworld.
That looks like it's happening, but as a TV series. not as an animated TV series, not as a movie.
Okay. And finally, Black Hole.
Black Hole, Roger Avery, who I did Beowulf with, who did Killing Zoe and Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
Co-writer of Pulp Fiction. And I wrote a script for Black Hole.
I guess I'm,
as far as I know, it's in a black hole right
now. I was
saying,
is this a remake of the Disney film of the
same
name?
Oh, no. This is Charles Burns' wonderful graphic novel about
a
sexually transmitted disease that turns kids into teenagers into monsters.
Completely.
And forces them to go and live in the woods.
On a double bill with the Disney film.
And
that black hole was blue, by the way. From 1980.
So no, all of the, actually that's not bad. That all of those films are actually real things.
So okay.
Normally when people say, oh, I've seen this on IMDb, they come up and say, so are you really doing Doctor Strange with Guillermo del Toro? And I say, no, I'm not. I really am not.
Well, after a while, it just seems like, you know, for me, it's like, I don't believe it until I see a poster and a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when actually things have happened. I had two friends, well, basement-dwelling friends, who were going to come to fisticuffs over Ken Branagh playing young Obi-Wan in the first three Star Wars. And I thought, really, you guys are going to fight over that? So... that's why we check in.
I love, I really do love the way that people seem to think that films are inevitable, that writers have supreme control, and that you can actually tell them what's going to happen with a film. The only thing that I know, having done all sorts of films and having knocked around in Hollywood now for 20 years every now and again, is... nobody knows anything, and what will happen, and if you'd asked me in 1997 what film of mine was most likely to happen, I would have told you Beowulf, because Roger, we'd just been given the green light, and Roger was about to fly around Canada, Newfoundland, Greenland, looking for locations.
Places with mud.
Absolutely. And then if you'd asked me in 2004 if any of the film scripts I'd written would never get made, I would have said, well, definitely Beowulf. That one will never happen. That's sitting there. It's this complicated chain of ownership. Who's going to make that thing? And so I was wrong both times. These days, all I know is that they will happen when they happen.
And you love libraries.
And I do love libraries. you have a daughter.
I do. This is our film sociology kids film correspondent, Emma Sosi, and I know she's been chomping at the bit. You have questions and or comments for Neil?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how long did it take you to write the book?
Of Coraline?
Yeah.
Coraline. You know, that shouldn't be a really hard question to ask somebody. You say, how long did it take you? And they tell you. The problem with Coraline, though, is I'm not really sure. I started writing Coraline in about 1990, maybe early 91. I showed it to an editor who read the first three chapters and said, Neil, which is what I'd written. And he said, it's really good, but obviously we can't publish it. Because it's horror for children, and that's too weird. And then I moved to America. So for a period of about 6 years, I would write about 2 pages a year on Coraline. I'd just go and write a little bit. By about 1998, I noticed, and I moved out here in 92, I noticed that the daughter I'd started writing it for, Holly, was now probably getting to be too old for it, and that I had a young daughter who was now 4, and if I didn't get a move on, she would be too old for it by the time I finished it. So I sent what I'd written of Coraline up to that point to my editor, a lady named Jennifer Hershey, and she phoned me up and she said, it's really good, what happens next? And I said, if you send me a contract, we'll both find out. So she sent me a contract, and then, but I didn't have any more time. So instead of reading before bed, which is what I'd always done up until that point all my life, I started writing before bed, and I had a notebook by the side of my bed, and I would write 50, 60, 70 words of Coraline, and then I'd go to sleep. And then finally, in about 2000, I went on a cruise for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is a First Amendment organization I'm part of, to preserve the rights of people who read, who write, who draw, who sell, who publish comics. And I was an attraction on this cruise, and I was meant to be working on my novel, American Gods. But my assistant had put, by serendipity, the wrong notebook into my bag. So I got to this cruise, and I discovered that the notebook I had with me was Coraline. Yeah. So on the cruise, I finished writing Coraline. So the truth is, I started writing it in 1991. I finished writing it in 2000. I have absolutely no idea how long it actually took me to write.
I see. Sometimes I try to write a book and it takes, like, when I was five, I tried to, like, write a book and I got, like, halfway through it when I became six. So it took me to write just half of the book and it only had, like, five pages.
Did you ever finish it?
I'm still working on it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Finishing books is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can start writing a book,
yeah.
But you know you're a proper author when you finish one.
Mm-hmm. Like in our school, we're writing a lot of books in our classes, just like small books.
I'm loving writing the small books right now.
Yeah.
They're sort of... Apart from anything else, it's really nice to do something that you can finish by tea time.
Yeah.
Emma, do you have any other questions for our guest?
Also,
or
I
comments?
Was, did anyone help you write Coraline at all?
No, it was all my fault. Any glory is mine and any blame is mine too. So for the people who think that writing Coraline was definitely a bad thing to do, I have to plead guilty.
I think it's good.
Good. I'll tell you what I did do, though. I stole the initial sort of idea from my daughter. Holly was about 4 years old. She used to come home from kindergarten. She would climb on my lap and dictate stories to me. And I would write them down. And they were always terrifying stories in which little girls, normally named Holly, would come home from school and discover that their mothers had been kidnapped by evil witches who were pretending to be their mothers, who would then normally lock them in the basement. And then with the aid of ghosts, they'd have to escape from the basement pursued by witches and go and try and find their real mother. And I thought, well, that's good. I'll write something like that for her. If that's the kind of thing she likes.
That's sort of like what happens in some of my dreams sometimes.
I think it's what happens in everybody's dreams.
Yeah.
My dreams involve Terry Hatcher, but that's a whole other. I can't.
His dreams involve pretty much girls.
Especially your mother.
Neil,
good answer. Yes.
I'm
the third smartest person in my house.
It's true.
It's true. Let's put it this way. It's a Jane Austen world. I'm just the dad. I was curious, what other screenplays have come out recently that have really tapped, that you've really enjoyed watching or listening to?
What's been coming out recently that I've really enjoyed? I loved the screenplay for An Education, McCombie. I thought that was beautifully constructed. And actually, the things that have impressed me no end recently are the first two Stephen Moffat episodes of the new season of Doctor Who, because I think Moffat is probably right now my favorite screenwriter.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinated with the way that he'll construct a story. And up until now, at least in sort of, you know, his work in Doctor Who and in Jekyll, he's been the scary one.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is watching him develop a whole new, have to learn a whole new range. He can't just be the scary one anymore. He has to be the welcome everybody in one, and then he has to be the exciting running about one, and it's absolutely fascinating.
I'm curious if Doctor Who fans are in England, what Star Trek fans are here in the United States?
No,
not as rabid.
Well, it's a general thing.
Okay,
I mean Doctor Who in England is a huge shared cultural experience. You're looking at the kind of viewing figures that tell you that 10% of the population of England is watching this when it's on. I don't know what that would extrapolate to in the US, but you're looking at something that is a shared cultural experience, and it's a shared cultural experience that goes back 45 years.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You got me there.
You know, it's what I guess Star Trek could have been.
Right. But I think I only ask because since then, I mean, with and of course it spawned a legion of films and other series, and you know they're still talking about it, and they're obviously, you know, they made the film last year, so you know 40 some odd years later. But I think it's a different, because there's a Deep Space Nine and there's a Next Generation. It's not like Shatner and Nimoy for the entire time. Although
The genius of Doctor Who was that moment in 1966 when the producers looked at this fairly popular, you know, and it was extremely popular TV show that they'd done. It had already spawned two spin-off movies by that point. And they looked at this and they went, our lead actor is getting too old, too doddery. He's not actually in very good health. What do? We want to keep this going. Mm-hmm. And they went, well, he's an alien. He can regenerate into somebody else. And the simplicity of that gave them something that was unmatched until anything like, you know, The Simpsons came along. For ways to cope with the fact that your actors may get old, die,
It's out of Terry Gilliam's last film with three actors replacing one.
Exactly. The glory of Doctor Who now is that you have this weird shared cultural experience where for those of us who have been through this 11 times before, watching people whose first experience of Doctor Who was David Tennant go, no, how can David Tennant stop being the Doctor and somebody else will come along? This is wrong. It will not work. And all of us going, no, Grasshopper, this will be just fine.
You make him walk on rice paper.
Absolutely.
Neil, thank you so much for spending time with us. This has been an absolute thrill.
Well, thank you, Bo. Thank you, Emma. Great questions.
Thanks.
Yeah, Emma fared better in that interview than I did. And Nicholas Smith, when I interviewed Nicholas Smith of Are You Being Served fame, immediately, as soon as we got done rolling tape, said Emma fared far better than I. So, as usual, she did. But thanks to Neil Gaiman for that lovely chat. And, part of the archives here at Film Sociology. From time to time, I might just pull into the archives and pull out an old interview because I can, because there's a lot of them, and the show's been on for quite a while. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!